Hi, I'm Sunny Dean.
And I'm Scott Drakeford.
And this is the Publishing Rodeo Podcast. In 2022, we both launched debut novels in the same genre with the same publisher in the same year. But despite having very similar starts, our books and subsequently each of our careers went in very different directions.
That pattern repeats itself throughout the industry over and over. Why do some books succeed while others seem to be dead on arrival?
In this podcast, we aim to answer those questions and many more, along with how to build and maintain an author career.
Everyone signing a contract deserves to know what they're really signing up for. In an industry that loves its secrets, we'll be sharing real details from real people. We'll cover the gamut of life as a Big Five published author, from agents to publishing contracts, finances, and more.
So welcome to this week's Publishing Rodeo and our usual chaotic, disorganized selves. We have with us this week Steve Laird. Am I saying your name right?
Yeah, Laird. Yeah, no, you did it. Laird. You did it really well. Okay, yeah, I get some weird versions of my surname. I always have to kind of clarify my surname normally.
So many weird versions of my first name. My favorite at the moment is Sunyiji. But anyway. So I saw a bookseller article some months ago talking about a cover designer who's launching his own podcast called Cover Meetings. And because I subscribed to the bookseller and I thought, well, that sounds interesting, because anyone who listens to this podcast for more than 5 minutes will know I'm interested in all aspects of publishing. And I started listening to that and thought it was a really good listen. So we asked Steve, who runs this podcast, if he would come and talk to us about cover design in the publishing world. And he's very kindly agreed. So could we ask you to introduce yourself, Steve, and talk a bit about how you came to be where you are and who you
are? Yeah, sure. Well, yeah, firstly, thanks for asking me onto the podcast. It was really nice to be asked. My name's Steve Laird. I'm solely a book cover designer. I've been working in the publishing industry since 2012. Before that, I was working in design agencies and doing branding and things like that. But I decided to make the switch and come into the publishing world. My first job in the industry was with Bloomsbury Publishing in London. And I worked there for kind of best part of 3 years, and then which was amazing. It was a fantastic experience to be part of the team there, and I learned so much in such a short space of time. And I generally design nonfiction books. It's quite easy as a cover designer to get pigeonholed into a certain genre. People, you know, I don't know how it happens, but you just get known for doing a certain thing, and that seems to be my thing. But I think it suits me mainly, and I think it kind of suits the way I design quite often. But I do like to do the old fiction cover now and again, just to kind of mix things up and, you know, keep yourself fresh. Although, you know, the worst thing you can do in this job is to go stale, so you always want to kind of challenge yourself and push yourself. So yeah, I was with Bloomsbury for about 3 years, and then from there went freelance. I've been freelancing now ever since. And you know, I thought I might not be able to stick with just book covers, but, you know, so far, touch wood, it's been like that. And, it's I always refer to it as the best job in the world. I feel really privileged to be working with books. It's brilliant.
Do you interact with authors much? Because I from our side, we only interact really with our editors, and we are very partitioned off. And I just wonder, like, because authors get told all kinds of things about book covers, and I wonder how much cover designers know about that.
No, I don't know. No, I feel like in the same, but on the other side, really, I feel shielded from the authors generally. There's been a couple of occasions where I've had contact with an author, but generally, more often than not, I'm going through either an art director who is then feeding back to an editor, or with the smaller publishers who don't have a dedicated art department, I'll be talking with the editor. But yeah, it's really, really rare to get exposed to the, I don't know, I'm not sure if we're not trusted. I don't know, we might say something stupid. But yeah, it's funny.
I think it's the other way around, probably. They're
they don't trust us.
They're trying to protect you, yeah.
So we get told things like this is something a few friends of mine have heard in genre fiction, that, you know, they get sent a cover by their editor and they'll say, oh, you know, I'm not happy this bit or that bit, or is this open to discussion? And the editors will say, no, the cover's designer has just done one draft and it's done, and that's all we can offer you. And then the author's like, oh, right, okay. And I kind of get the sense that might not be true.
No, that's
I'm
not
interested.
No, that's never been my experience. I guess from my perspective, it feels like a cover is agreed on in-house, and it, you know, there's lots of channels that has to go through. A lot of people have to sign it off, and then it gets to that point, and then I get the impression it's then presented to the author, you know, in a kind of ta-da moment. And then at that point, the author can say yes, love it, or say no, hate it. And then, you know, sometimes that's a case of just tweaking. Sometimes it's completely start again. But my experience has been, yeah, there's so much back and forth, like sometimes too much back and forth. But, yeah. That's not been my experience at all, really. I think you need the authors to buy into the cover as well. Essentially, you know, I think as a cover designer, we're creating something that is representing someone else's art, essentially, you know. So, you know, the author has to engage with it. Otherwise, it feels like it's probably not doing its job. You know, obviously, we have a responsibility to potential readers and things like that. But ultimately, you want the author to be happy. You know, that sometimes we get an email forwarded from an author who, you know, is raving about a cover and how much they love it. And, you know, you get one of those emails and it's, you know, makes you smile. You feel like you've done your job.
I would say at our level, we don't tend to get a lot of input from Ian Scott. Maybe if you're sort of George R. Martin or some of the more important nonfiction authors you're working with. But that said, I did really appreciate my cover designer, especially in the USA side. He went and like watched YouTube videos on how to make paper art and cut up a book and stuff to try and do it. And I thought that, I mean, they ended up bringing a paper artist to do it for him. But yeah. I was impressed with that.
Yeah.
But so how does the process work? Like what happens when, you know, from the very start of designing a cover, are you given just like a brief and you work through that?
Yeah. I think it's generally the same most of the time, but it always feels slightly different for every book, which I think again is one of the great things about this job, because no book feels the same, no job feels the same, which, you know, really keeps the process alive, really. I think a lot of cover designers, you don't want to feel like you're just doing the same thing all the time, and that could lead to you making the same moves all the time and things like that. So every book is different, so that normally makes hopefully the process a bit different as well sometimes. But yeah, we'll initially receive a brief from the art director or editor, and sometimes we might have the whole manuscript available, sometimes we don't. Sometimes you just get a little synopsis to just give you a little flavor of the book, but normally they'll give you an idea of where they want it to sit in the market and things like that. And they'll give you comparison covers, you know, which sometimes are useful, sometimes aren't useful. And I think, you know, the more experience you have working with books, you know when to follow that kind of guidance and when to kick against it maybe. And then from that point, I guess it's just down to idea generation and just having a play and seeing what happens. And normally given a couple of weeks from the point of being given a brief, and then after a couple of weeks I'll give a range of options to the art director or editor, and then the fun begins in trying to actually get one of them approved.
So I remember from your podcast, you said sometimes that the briefs could be a little bit things like make it look like a bestseller, or people just shooting down ideas but for really random reasons, like they don't like the color purple, or they don't vibe it, and they don't have that kind of necessarily artistic feedback, but they're just kind of giving like.
Yeah.
Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I'm shielded from a lot of this now being freelance, because I don't participate in weekly cover meetings within the publisher. But yeah, it was being in a cover meeting is a funny place, because your work is really, you know, it's really being judged, and sometimes quite brutally. But then, it can be a confusing place sometimes, because people will shoot a cover down because it doesn't feel, you know, something enough, and or, you know, I don't like that cover because it's got a bird on it, and, you know, just really random things. It's like, huh? So you're trying to translate kind of why people aren't responding to something. And obviously, you know, there must be a reason why it's not engaging them. But sometimes that description that's being fed back to you is a little bit woolly. You kind of feel like you're guessing sometimes. But yeah, I think again, that's it keeps it interesting and challenging on our part for sure. There's no such thing as a perfect brief necessarily, but you know, I think designers do work best quite often when there is a little bit of constraint. Sometimes we, you know, on the odd occasion, we'll get an open brief where someone will say, "Do what you like," which on the face of it sounds like an amazing opportunity because, you know, you can go crazy. But normally when that happens, you'll send them something and you'll quickly realize that actually wasn't an open brief and they don't actually like anything you did. And here's the actual brief. But I think designers work best quite often when there is an element of constraint, because quite often that's where creativity comes from. But also not at the same time, it's a tricky balance. You don't want it too tied down because then you've got nowhere to go, you know. And I think, you know, a lot of genres have almost like an agreed look of what a certain type of book looks like. But I think a lot of designers are obviously trying to push the needle where they can and push things forward, essentially. So otherwise things just become stale.
You said something interesting. It was actually Sun. You make it look like a bestseller. I mean, on the face, it sounds like a ridiculous request.
Mm.
But is that a thing in your line of business?
Oh,
you know, is there a clear difference between, oh, this is a mid-list, the don't worry about it. this is a bestseller. Give it your best shot. What does that delineation look like on your side?
I'm not really sure myself, to be honest, but I think that is something that does get thrown around quite a lot. I don't tend to get it too much with the types of briefs that I get given. I think it quite often is thrown more at people working with mass market fiction or literary fiction. I think it, yeah, that whole, you know, make it look like a big book kind of feel, which I think generally loosely translates as see what's selling really well in this calendar year and then try and make it look vaguely in the same world but not exactly the same kind of so and that's where you get all these covers which very similar, yeah,
same.
because I think people, I think publishers sometimes make the mistake that they think, you know, a reason a book sells isn't always because of the cover. You know, there could be a myriad of factors of why a book sells, as your podcast always looks into. But I think publishers sometimes are a little bit lazy, I think, with trying to replicate a look of a particular book that's done really well and then think that's going to just work exactly the same next time. I think that kind of make it look like a bestseller thing, it's kind of meaningless, really. But we kind of understand what they're saying when you hear those kind of things being thrown around.
Yeah. And I mean, I think every author would like their cover to look like a bestseller, right? So do they hand you, assuming other variables are held the same, right? Assuming it's the same publisher, art director, whatever. Do they hand you a different budget, a different timeline? Or is it really a matter of the ones that don't come down the pipeline with make it a bestseller, you just kind of do whatever you want?
Yeah, from my perspective, I try to approach every job the same, really. I just want to – I've never really been one to – it sounds really silly. I don't necessarily want to work on bestsellers. You know, obviously I do because, you know, I want every book to be a bestseller, as I just said, but, you know, I don't mind if I'm working on with a really small name author with low sales expectations, if I'm allowed to be creative. That's ultimately my priority, is to do justice to the book that I'm given, and I'll create something which I think works well for the book and for the market. And then fingers crossed it sells, you know, it kind of comes down to that from my perspective. But then this bestseller thing is tricky because it's when a brand comes to you and says, "I want to look like Apple," you know, well, you be like Apple first, and I'll give you a brand which is like Apple. You know what comes first? The ultimately, the book needs to be amazing. You know, we could dress it up and make it look however you like, but the book comes first, really.
You have more freedom than like an in-house designer, because I think you've done both, haven't you? So
yeah,
how does that position compare?
I don't think I have more freedom. I don't think as a freelancer. I think there's pros and cons of being on kind of both, really. I think being in-house, you're afforded more time with editors and things like that, and you can build up relationships with kind of art directors, editors, and stuff, and that might help your process a little bit as well. I guess that I feel like I probably have been allowed a little. I've allowed myself more freedom being freelance in a way. I don't know, that might sound strange, but if I'm in an office environment where there's lots of different people, I might not be as inclined to do something crazy as I might when I'm in my own studio and it's just me, and if I do something it looks terrible, I don't look stupid. But I think the best thing about this job is it can take you into lots of weird places. And the other week I was cutting out letters and setting them on fire and things like that. That would be a bit harder to do if I was in house. Maybe I wouldn't be quite as inclined to do it. I don't know. I'm not sure. But I feel like maybe it's just because I've been in the industry longer now, and maybe I'm a bit more confident to try new things and stuff than I was in earlier in my kind of publishing career. I don't know. But I think talking on my podcast with a couple of art directors and people working in house, it sounds like people are really encouraged to kind of stretch themselves working house and not be restrained by anything. So I don't think it makes too much difference. I think publishers generally give the space for creatives to be creative. Yeah.
And this is a dicey question. You don't have to answer it. And also, I'll just say, like, off record, if there's stuff we ask, you can always tell me to cut it.
Yeah, that's cool.
But is there a pay difference between being in-house and freelance? And, like, what is the pay situation like in your industry, if that's okay to ask? Because I know authors, it really varies.
Yes, it's a funny old area, this one. Starting the podcast, I seem to have thrown myself into the middle of the conversation. But I think pay is always been one of those things in publishing generally, but I don't know so much about other departments, but in art departments it feels like fees for freelancers basically haven't changed much in about two decades. It obviously isn't sustainable for a lot of people, and puts people off staying in the industry, won't attract certain talent. I think it tends to lead to lots of other problems, where you get a certain type of person who can basically afford to work in publishing, and that kind of feeds into this issue that publishing has, being too middle class and all that kind of stuff. But I think it feels like in this past few years, collectively, a lot of designers seem to be talking about it more and being a bit more open about it. Because I think there's always been a fear for particularly freelancers to be talking about pay, that you kind of feel like, if you... Is that kind of feeling, if you cause too much of a stink, that people are going to stop giving you work and things like that? And everyone I know working in the industry absolutely love this job, and wouldn't wish to do anything else, really. But at the same time, people need to be paid what they're worth, essentially. Think in the past year or two, with cost of living crisis and things like that, I think it's really jerked quite a few of us into pushing for fee increases. And I know a lot of people who have been asking for more money, and I would encourage every freelancer to do the same if they're listening, because I think it's important. I think we need that collective movement, really, to push things on. I think pay, like salaries in-house, have been really low as well. I can't really speak on much of, I've been out of in-house for a little while now. I'm not really sure wages and salaries, but I think they're increasing. Probably not enough if you're trying to work as an intern in London, but hopefully it's moving in the right direction, just probably a little bit slowly. But I think it's something we need to talk about more kind of as designers, because I think that's the way things will change ultimately. And rights as well for designers, which is another big one, which is a bit of a minefield for freelancers as well.
I've got one quick design question, and then I was going to kind of ask about the elephant in the room in a second, that being AI. I was really interested in one of your early episodes. You're talking about how thumbnails have changed design. And just for anyone who's not had a chance to listen to that podcast, would you be interested in going over that a bit and how it's impacting the way book covers look?
You mean like thumbnails on Amazon and things like that?
Yeah.
It's always been, you know, there's a lot of people working in our industry who have been designing covers, you know, before Amazon kind of came along and changed everything, where, you know, their only real consideration was how it looked on a printed jacket or cover. But since I've been working, there's always been this weird tension between you're creating a printed object, but then also people have this expectation that everything should be legible on a tiny little thumbnail JPEG. And for me, that's not realistic. But I think unfortunately, publishers, wrongly in my opinion, and some people might have a different opinion, but you know, you'll get a different answer maybe from someone else. In my opinion, from my perspective, publishers, I'm always being asked to increase the size of everything in the hope that it might be able to be read in a tiny little thumbnail. I think that the result of that is you lose contrast on covers quite quickly. If everything is just dialed up, everything just feels like it's really shouting at you all the time. As a result, you go into a bookshop and it kind of feels like every book is almost screaming at you. It's like screaming for attention. And it's a particular problem, you know, with nonfiction books as well, because normally there's a bit more copy on the cover. You've got subtitles to be dealing with and things like that. They want everything big. They want the title big, the subtitle big, the author big, the quote big, the whatever icon or illustration you might have on there big. And before you know it, you stop almost seeing the cover. It's just like visual noise coming at you. I've spoken about this on a couple of the episodes of Cover Meeting. I wish publishers maybe would be a bit more flexible with how a book is put out in the world. You know, we have the printed object, which we still value. We have JPEGs on Amazon. We have Instagram, TikTok. These books are being seen in a myriad of different ways. Why are we creating just one standalone cover, which is supposed to be fit for purpose of all these different things? Considering things are so easily, you can change things really easily on a computer so quickly now. Why not have a version of a cover which is for the book? Why not have a version which is for Amazon? Why not have a version which is for Twitter, Instagram, etc.? Yes, it's a little bit more work for the designer, but personally, I would do that if it meant that the book wasn't spoilt, essentially. Sometimes I feel like the covers are spoilt because of this kind of push for everything being big so it can be seen on a tiny, tiny thumbnail. Also, sorry, I'm kind of ranting here. Also, I don't really believe people shop in that way on things like Amazon and things like that. You know, I think the way you browse a bookshop is different to how you use Amazon. A thumbnail on Amazon or any other book retailer online is supported with copy right next to it. It has the thumbnail, but literally right next to it is the title, the author, the subtitle. It's not like you have to read it just on that little thumbnail. There's other additional copy available to you. I don't think people are just sat on Amazon browsing through tiny thumbnails and then just clicking on one aimlessly. I don't think people shop like that on Amazon personally. I could be wrong. So I feel like this kind of forcing everything to work on a thumbnail is a big mistake and it's a frustration for me, and I think probably quite a big frustration for a lot of book cover designers, because I don't think it serves the book well, ultimately.
You don't get illustrated covers anymore for our genre. I really miss those, the 90s sci-fi fantasy painted covers.
Yeah, well, I think it kind of forces people into a certain way of designing almost. And again, kind of feeds into this phenomena of everything looking a little bit too similar.
Very early on, you had an episode with Michaela Alcano.
Yeah.
Who, if for listeners tuning in, if you don't know Michaela Alcano, but you read sci-fi and fantasy books, you've probably seen the cover she's designed, like Night Circus, Shannon Chakrabarty. Naomi Novik, I think. Some Patrick Rothfuss covers, definitely. Jennifer Saint. So, you know, names that we would recognize. And she had a bit of a viral incident online about an essay she wrote about AI. And I was interested when she came onto your podcast to give her side of it. And
yeah.
That was helpful. But I have to say, I personally did still think that she was being a bit naive. But I'm interested to hear your take on AI, and especially, you know, you're talking about pay is stagnating, publishers wanting to be lazy and cut costs.
Yeah, it's
What's your stance on it? Go for it.
Well, yeah, it's.
How many enemies would you like to make today, Steve?
I really appreciated that conversation with Michaela. I mean, I think she, I guess, opened my eyes to the debate almost, because it did hit like a bolt out of the blue, the AI thing, because it is such a quick emerging technology. We're all trying to catch up still, no matter what industry you're working in. Personally, I wish AI just would disappear, but it's not going to. I've been reading a lot about, since I started the podcast, really, I've been in a bit of a rabbit hole with AI. It's kind of terrifies me, but I feel like we've got a duty to learn about as much as we can, because I think if we do just bury our head in the sand, I think it could all go quite badly, quite quickly, for anyone in kind of creative industries. And I have read a lot of pieces where there is kind of a more positive spin on AI. Ultimately, I think AI in its current incarnation, obviously, things are going to change, you know, exponentially year on year. AI as it stands now is a very reactive form of creativity. You know, you can create something really quickly and it can look quite interesting sometimes, but ultimately it's just replicating what's been fed into it. So within that, there is a challenge to anyone creative to force yourself to be one step ahead of AI. You know, if you're constantly evolving your work, then AI will always be trailing, you know, in your path. I guess where the potential naivety comes from with that is ultimately who is in charge of making decisions with how to use AI. If publishers decide to use AI to create cover designs, they might not look very interesting, but the person in charge of that publisher might not give a damn. You know, they're cutting out a big cost from their perspective, and they've got something which looks okay. So I feel like we have to make sure that publishers and decision makers within publishers value creativity. Everyone seems to be making the right noises so far on that front, but things change, and, you know, someone will create a publisher where AI is heavily involved, and traditional publishers will have to compete with that publisher. And then that's where things start potentially changing. Kind of more broadly, I personally can't see myself using AI to create work. I don't see why I would want to. It must be the same for authors. You know, I hear
a lot of writing.
Why would you delegate that off to a machine? And also, like, writing a book is hard. It's not easy, but that's the point, isn't it? Yeah. If it was easy, it would be vastly less a lot less interesting, and everyone could do it. And I think going through the struggle of writing something or creating something is that's that's the joy. That's the process. That's the kind of the humanity of what we all do. So I don't understand this need to aid creativity in whatever guise it may be, and this obsession with speed. So what if it can churn out a cover design or a 10,000 word essay in 30 seconds? Why do we need it? I don't understand why we need it fundamentally. All it seems to be doing is helping people who couldn't do it otherwise to do it.
You get a lot of people in writing groups who have the kind of, I've got an idea, but I just need someone to do the writing for me. You know, that is like literally the whole thing. That's like saying I want to have success. I just need someone to like do my job for me. And I think those people, I mean, it just scares. There's so many ads for AI because I'm an old crusty person who still has a Facebook account. Every second post is like an AI ad. I block them. They're still there.
Yeah.
And the other thing that freaks me out is like, we used to see AI covers come up on social media and we'd sometimes post them Discord and go like, oh yeah, that's AI. You can count the fingers and see all the rough bits. And now it's like we post one and we're all looking at it, arguing for 15 minutes. Like, is it AI? Is it AI they've touched up? Because it's getting better and they're getting better at blending it. And that part unnerves me as well.
Yeah, no, it scares me to my core. But yeah, it's one of those things where you start thinking about it too much and it's hard not to be depressed by the time you come out of those thought patterns. But I feel like as a community, whether that be authors or designers or anyone really, I think collective action, I think almost to kind of, I think people need to pull together. Cause I think as a freelancer, you know, you can't do anything on your own. Like, you know, I really believe we have to champion ourselves and make sure that publishers and the people running publishers aren't tempted, essentially. Because
if it reassures you at all, a lot of people I know, just anecdotally, are getting anti AI clauses in their contracts. And there are specific publishers who are very resistant to it, and there are some who are much more amenable.
Yeah,
and we're getting it for audio as well. I think something that would help in the UK is if as many people as possible join the Society of Authors and we're kind of using that as leverage.
I do think you make a good point, Steve, that like it or not, we as artists, whatever our medium, are likely going to be competing with AI in some fashion. And AI is going to continue to improve to the point that, and this is just Scott talking, you know, don't come after Senyu or Steve for this. at some point, it's going to consume the work of people doing things that aren't all that creative, right? Mm. The people who are just churning things out to churn things out, who don't go through a very exhaustive creative process, and who are okay with mediocrity or at the very least some form of uniformity rather than, you know, tied to their own sense of style or sense of personal accomplishment. I mean, I think that means that if anything, bespoke work and detailed, meaningful work becomes even more valuable, right?
Yeah.
I hope. But my primary issue with the use of AI right now and what I hope happens and where there could be very big legal ramifications for people and publishers using AI right now, because the companies putting out these tools are, as I'm sure you are all well aware, are training their models on in some instances, on copyrighted data, on copyrighted work.
Yeah.
And that's obviously a huge issue. You know, we had OpenAI's CEO, who I don't like very much, say, I haven't liked him for a very long time.
Before it was cool.
I really did. So this is tangent time, but I come from, you know, the tech world, at least sort of, want to be in the tech world, at least from engineering and software and product and everything. And so he used to be the president of a group called Y Combinator, which is honestly a really cool startup accelerator that I applied to once upon a time. And they fund all sorts of different startups, but that's where he was before this OpenAI thing started. But he's never had a startup success on his own. Like he started a startup. It raised a ton of money and failed miserably. He tripped somehow into being the president of YC, and this super smart guy named Paul Graham has some sort of really, really creepy man crush on him. And so he's just been a parasite in YC for like 10, 15 years. And then somehow he brown-nosed his way into being involved in this OpenAI thing. And I did this actually. If you go to ChatGPT and you press it enough in asking whether Sam Altman, I shouldn't say his name. I'm gonna get so much hate.
I'll edit it.
But maybe not. We're truth tellers, right? But if you press ChatGPT enough and ask it whether Sam Altman has any personal accomplishments of his own, it will admit that no, he does not. After it says, oh, well, he's been at Y Combinator for this many years and he's worth a bajillion dollars because he's, found his way into investing in all these companies probably without his own money. He has a sister who has made some really horrible accusations against him other brother as well. Yeah, I won't go into that because I can't speak to whether those are true. But anyway, I've had a problem with Sam Altman for a long time. Not really a personal problem because I'm not on that level to have a personal problem, but more a problem born of envy, because if somebody's going to trip into success, why not me? Anyway, my big problem is really that using AI in this age of companies that are producing these models without checking and without paying for appropriately IP and creators' rights, a publisher or whoever, but a publisher who uses AI art is endorsing bastardization of IP law, which is crazy because their entire fucking industry, their entire model is based on IP. They will rake people over the coals if somebody goes and tries to mess with their copyrighted shit, right? And the stuff that they've bought the licenses for. But when it's somebody else's IP, all of a sudden it's okay. So anyway.
The Disney sex fault, all IP.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's very recently.
You don't know what that is, people, go Google.
I don't know what it is, and I'm not going to ask Sunny about it because I don't know that we want to go that weird on the podcast. But apparently, we're going to.
Okay, anything you draw, Essa said, anything you draw like that looks like a Disney character, right? They're very strict about IP. That means it belongs to them. So if you, as an artist, jokingly draw like the Beauty and the Beast, getting it on in a very obvious, explicit way. That gets, they can't publish that, but you can't have it because it's there. So it goes into this big vault full of other forbidden Disney images, which I'd like to think of as the Disney sex vault.
Cool. Yeah. Anyway, the OpenAI. Well, I'll move on from that as quickly as I can.
I think
OpenAI. CTO was recently in an interview asked directly, are you training on copyrighted material? Are you training on YouTube videos? Are you training on these certain things? And her only response was, ooh, I don't know. Like, how do you not know? Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
I don't really know how anyone's even going to find out. It feels like the horse has bolted. I don't know.
There are lawsuits, right? I haven't followed the lawsuits, but there are lawsuits out there from larger companies saying, hey, and larger names saying, hey, you used our copyrighted shit, give us money or you're dead. Hopefully that's pursued because it's super possible to train these models on freely accessible and or paid for data, right? Yeah. Like it's stuff that's out of copyright, stuff that's made open source, whatever. Like it's possible. Or maybe just like pay people what they're worth for their art. If that's what you want to do, and you want to create an engine that creates art in the style of Steve Laird, you pay Steve Laird for his book of work, and you create a model that can create what he does, and you give him some percent of royalties on any output that is used commercially from his work in that model. Like, it's not that hard. They can do this. They're doing incredible things with their technology. And then when they're being held accountable for it, all of a sudden, oh, well, I don't know how we'd even do that.
I think as well, it's like designers and artists and anyone using platforms like things like Instagram, for example. You know, we all upload our work onto Instagram. You know, we all accept terms and conditions on using that site. We have no idea how those images are being used, and I suspect they're probably being used to train things like AI, you know, large language models and things like that. So it's a kick in the teeth, isn't it, when, you know, it could potentially do a lot of people out of a career, and we've actually helped it on its way. It's ironic. Extreme.
The poisoning
that's
thing
a good
mentioned,
point.
Scott, I'd heard that is happening on LinkedIn particularly, because LinkedIn already is like, I mean, firstly, LinkedIn is a hell site. If you're on LinkedIn, what the fuck? I'm sorry for you. But LinkedIn has lots of corporate speak.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it now is like fully AI automated. If you want it to be, you can tell it to write you like a profile and messages and all this stuff. But everything you write is being fed back into the LinkedIn AI. So it just becomes this kind of cannibalizing, incestuous, like some kind of monster out of Severance. Like it's...
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's not surprising because Microsoft owns LinkedIn, and Microsoft also is a heavy investor in OpenAI, and they have the rights to pre-AGI OpenAI tech. So that's super not surprising. What Steve just said a second ago, though, is really interesting and something that creators might want to take stock of, that in using popular social media sites, we absolutely have agreed to, you know, certain terms that probably nobody knows what they are. Mm-hmm. And it's less of an issue for us as writers because it's not like we're uploading our entire book, you know, to Instagram, but we are sharing our covers, right? And we don't necessarily have the rights to those covers, but when our publisher does it, is that an issue? When a cover designer shares their art to Instagram, is that giving, you know, Instagram/Meta the right to use that in training models? I don't know what's in those T's and C's.
It's such a minefield. And I think the frustrating thing with AI is I could see a few potential benefits to AI, but it seems to want to do the fun stuff for us, and that's what it seems to be being sold on. You know, if I had an AI that was essentially a form of a personal assistant, and I could just talk to it and say, hey, can you invoice such and such for X amount for this job? And it just does it for me. I can see how that would be useful. But I don't want to, you know, I open up Photoshop and I've got windows constantly opening up to me, trying to get me to use AI and things like that. It's like, well, no, that's why I'm here. So I just wish it would concentrate on the things we probably need a bit more help with. And
oh my God, an AI to write confrontational emails.
But a lot of the things I find frustrating about my job probably could be solved by AI, you know. But
your CPA is crying in the background.
Yeah.
See, that's the problem with any you know, especially tech that automates things is. Somebody's cut out, right? And somebody's got to change what they're doing in some fashion. Yeah. And I don't think artists are immune from that. I don't think writers or visual artists are immune from that. And we do have to keep up, and we are going to have to understand what the gaps in the market are going to be in the future world that is going to go to that future state, whether we want it to or not. Yeah. But yeah, I do think there are limits and definitely things we should be holding the people we work with accountable for.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you ever feel the need to provide like evidence? Is that a thing that happens now? Because I know there were some contested covers which came out in our genre, and you know, the designers are feeling like they had to show stages, show their work.
Yeah. Not so far, but I could see it happening. I could see it happening for sure. But yeah, thankfully not yet. But yeah, if you kind of get to the point where you have to evidence everything you're doing, just in case someone challenges you, it could be tricky as well. But yeah, I think there's going to be all sorts of things that crop up, you know, as the industry battles with how to integrate AI into our world.
Absolutely. We've now reached the, unless you've got further questions, Scott, we've now reached the part of the podcast where I ask what kind of, if you want to tell us what the smallest hill you'd be willing to die on, and it can be a really petty fun thing. So
my thing is work related, cover quotes on front covers of book jackets. I hate quotes on front covers. I loathe it. I loathe them. I wish it wasn't a thing. That's probably quite controversial in publishing circles.
I love it. Go for it.
But I think, again, for me as a designer, it quite often muddies the intention behind a cover and what we're trying to communicate. I think most quotes are bullshit. I think they're quite often made up. They have got that it often feels like David Pearson, who was one of the guests on cover the first season of Cover Meeting. I've heard him speak at a different event where he says that the language that is used on quotes is so dialed up to the point where it becomes meaningless. Yeah. You know, everything is fantastic, amazing, brilliant. And it you see it so often. It just, I don't know, does anyone believe that anymore? Like it just seems pointless to me. I don't know if it's just the kind of the publishing equivalent of just name dropping, that someone knows such and such, whoever's appearing on the cover.
There's two things with it. The first is the name. I think it doesn't really matter what you say, but I have had a lot of people tell me, oh, I tried your book because V.E. Schwab blurbed it.
Yeah.
But I think oftentimes, like if I send in a blurb, often the publisher will come back and be like, actually, can we reword it like this? It's like, yeah, fine, right? So it does go through a filter. The other area it helps is Amazon listings, where there's like an editorial review section, and the more you have of them, the more the algorithm likes. So they just try and get as many as possible. But anyway,
I think they're useful in certain contexts, and I think that's what back covers are for.
Yeah, that's totally fair.
Again, it's just this kind of visual clutter thing. You know, there's already enough on there, and I think it's one of my favorite moans I have it to my partner. If and it normally happens at the last minute, you've got a cover you're really, really pleased with, and then at the last minute they drop in a quote. It's like, oh, fuck's sake. And then I'll have a moan to my partner, she's not a designer, she's not in publishing, she doesn't, you know, she's not in this space, and you know, she just does give that kind of look of just, oh, get over it. Just get over yourself. I think it's particularly with a lot of my work, which tends to be quite restrained and kind of stripped back and simple. And I think people just think, oh, you know, we'll just add a quote on there, that's fine. But I think it doesn't take a lot for a cover to kind of collapse. And if you add something on there, it can quite often affect like the balance of a cover and essentially how it's communicating. So I wish we could go back to a time when front covers were for illustrative elements and titles, and all the quotes are on the back cover. I think it doesn't take much to turn the book around and look at all the quotes from the lovely people saying nice things in lots of dialed up languages about it. So I'm prepared to die on that hill. I'm not going to change my mind about it. I will be, you know, fretting under my breath every single time it happens, and it's never going to change.
that's a really good one. And I just scrolled through all of your covers that are on your site, and I do notice that there are relatively few that have quotes on the cover. So,
yeah, I think
you fought for it, huh?
Yeah, it's that tricky thing of being a freelancer, of the point where you know. am I being a bit of a brat about this and making a nuisance of myself? There's a fine line.
Yeah.
A lot of these I can't see where you'd fit a quote on, like the left behind one, where it's like, well, you actually need all of that space. And...
Oh, they manage.
Just shrink everything.
And sometimes it happens without me even knowing about it. I'll send off the files to print and I see the final book and it's got a bloody quote's been slapped on the front. That's a killer. But yeah, I don't know. I think I'm due to moan about cover quotes in an upcoming episode of my podcast with someone else who I know equally despises them. So I think we'll have a good therapy session together at some point.
Yeah. On that note, actually, would you like to kind of plug yourself where people can find you, your work, your podcast? We do get some industry people that listen in, so you never know.
Yeah. You can see my work at my website is leard.co.uk. That's LEARD. I'm on Instagram at leard_design, I think my handle is. And then the podcast is called Cover Meeting, which you can find through anywhere you listen to your podcasts. I'm not sure when this episode's going out because
a couple of weeks.
I'm actually launching a dedicated website for it, covermeeting.com, which in a couple of weeks it should be there for people to see, and you can find out a bit more information about the people that feature on the podcast.
Oh, I'm glad you're doing that, because that is always a pet peeve of mine when I look for websites on podcasts, just because it's a lot easier to search episodes and you can't find them. And it's like, you can't search Spotify. It's like this annoying thing.
Yeah.
So if you're making a podcast, guys, please, basic website. It's so helpful.
Yeah, it should be. I think it is live at the moment. It's just not fully functioning. But
I was on it earlier, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you so much for coming on. That was a lot of fun and really informative.
Yeah.
We really appreciate it.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for asking me. Hopefully it's been helpful.
You've been listening to the Publishing Radio Podcast with Sunny Dean and Scott Drakeford. Tune in next time for more in-depth discussion on everything publishing industry. See you later.